getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
BCFM.
You're losing the war. And don't tell me you're not, because I'm in a place of great knowledge about who's winning and who's losing this war. And I can assure you, you're losing the war.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Why are the families of the lost Malaysian airliner being given the runaround, and what possible motive could there be to kidnap and possibly kill these people? Fed up with seeing satellite pictures of wreckage that isn't there, and all the wasted air miles of searches that then go round and round and find nothing? Well, so are the families of the 239 passengers and crew on Malaysian MH370. So tonight we explore some of the cyber hijack theories and, more importantly, motives for an attack on Malaysia or China. And back to the bad old days of US-sponsored military rule in Egypt this week, as well as in Turkey shooting down a Syrian jet, and a leaked phone call from Prime Minister Erdogan that he wants to attack his own country to get a war started with Syria. Well, no wonder he wants to ban Twitter and YouTube in Turkey, because everybody's talking about their crooked, warmongering leader. Plus, a look at the Israel lobby and their so-called Christian supporters. What are they saying to win the hearts and minds for Tel Aviv and Netanyahu's Likud party? And we round off last week's interview with what the BBC aren't reporting. That's Occupy London and their think tanks still going strong this week with some solutions. So that Osborne and the Treasury can't say nobody told them. Britain's bank has induced economic nightmare with Occupy London's Clive Menzies. And part three of Paul Mason's series that he thinks could not be made in Britain today on the First World War. Part three, the revolutions. But we start this week with a look at the Ukraine, Martin, and one of the chief far-right leaders, someone that a lot of people had their eyes on, was shot and killed this week by the Ukrainian police. When I first saw it, I thought, well, this is something with some sort of clash with the Russians in Crimea, but nothing to do with that. The Australian SBS News Service are reporting that members of Ukraine's far-right have smashed windows and threatened to force their way into the Kiev Parliament building after the police shot dead their leader. This is Oleksandr Muchko, the regional leader of the Pravi Sector, the right sector party, in a shootout that erupted during a raid to arrest him in the western city of Rivne this week. So what's going on here? This is a clash between the far right and the Ukrainian government. In a way, what they're saying is that actually they're not going to go along with some of the far right that were involved in the Maidan protests and taking over the parliament building in Kiev.
Well, what the protesters are saying is that he was shot in cold blood by the police, and that he's basically been assassinated by his political rivals within the new coalition. So, obviously, all I know is what I've been reading on the internet about it. And of course, his followers then turned up to try and storm the parliament building, which is exactly what they'd done previously to put the government in power. So, you know, it's a bit like the New Model Army rebelling during the English Civil War, if you like. But it shows how unstable the new regime in Ukraine actually is, and that it's actually based upon street thuggery.
According to the Russian news agencies, the group's slain leader was wanted in Russia, which accuses him of causing the death of about 20 Russian soldiers while fighting alongside separatists in Chechnya. Yeah. And what does this all mean for the future of Ukraine? Because, I mean, it sort of slipped off the headlines a bit this week after the Crimea vote. And, I mean, is it going to settle down, do you think?
Well, what seems to be happening is is that a certain stability has come to the situation in the sense that that Crimea is definitely going to remain part of Russia. I can't see that changing, despite the vote in the UN this week. And the West is now attempting to consolidate the new regime in Kiev. But, of course, what hasn't been noticed in the mainstream media is that they've been signing these deals with the IMF, which are essentially going to lead to the impoverishment of the population, particularly in the East Ukraine, which is the most industrialised part of the Ukraine and therefore the most vulnerable to IMF structural adjustment. And therefore tensions are likely to emerge between the East Ukrainian population and the current regime in Kiev. And there are tensions within the regime in Kiev between mainstream sort of neoconservative money oriented people like Yatsenyuk, who is the prime minister, and the stormtroopers who basically kicked their way to power for him. So there's a tension within the coalition between extreme right forces like Pravi Sector and what you might call mainstream IMF aligned forces.
Well, the European Union certainly got their way because they wanted to do a deal with Kiev, and they did. But to what extent were they actually involved, do you think, in the takeover at Maidan and the takeover of the parliament building in Kiev?
What seems to have disappeared from international discourse, although not, of course, from the Russian media, is that the Estonian foreign minister was bugged speaking to Catherine Ashton from the EU, saying that his information was that the protesters and the police had both been shot by snipers associated with the current regime. And I would suggest that the UNO organisation in Ukraine has been, for example, fighting in Chechnya and have been working with Western intelligence services for a very long time, going back to the 1960s, 1950s. Now, in other words, what's been buried in the Western press is the fact that the killings which led to the change of regime are not carried out, weren't carried out by Yanukovych, weren't carried out by the Russians. They were carried out probably by NATO forces as part of the Gladio network, which we often cover in this show. Gladio was the secret network set up by NATO to carry out terrorism in both East and Western Europe after the war. And I think what we're seeing, the Gladio network were activated around the Maidan process. Protests. And we saw similar things happening at the beginning of protests in Syria, where unidentified gunmen shot both police officers and protesters. And we've seen similar things in Egypt and in Venezuela, because it's part of the NATO colour revolution playbook, which is no longer just kumbaya. It does involve bloodshed.
Now, I know you mentioned that last week this transatlantic trade and investment partnership. It strikes me as quite amazing that you think that what's been going on in Ukraine is a way of ramping up tension within Europe, between Russia and Europe, in order to persuade the European countries that this transatlantic trade and investment partnership is good for them. This is a trade deal written about by George Monbiot in The Guardian at the beginning of March. Give and take in the US-EU trade deal. Sure, we give and the corporations take. He's saying that essentially this trade deal has little to do with removing trade taxes. What it's about is a single market between the United States and the European Union, described as the biggest trade deal in the world ever. Actually, you know, the whole EU started, didn't it, with a single market within the EU, and then it moved on to political union. So this trade deal, my immediate thoughts are, is this some sort of Trojan horse that would then actually bring some kind of political union between the EU and the US?
Well, a political union in the sense of being part of the US empire. Effectively, the euro would be subordinated to the dollar, and all of the EU's trade regulations, you were talking about how they're forced down on Britain and other EU member countries, all US trade regulations would then be forced on us via the back door of this trade agreement.
You see, what happens is you get politicians drafting legislation, and then what happens is it's challenged by a corporation. They say, you can't do that. Yeah. It's part of this deal.
One of the most contentious aspects of this deal is that corporations will be able to take governments to court for loss of earnings if they carry out policies which are against the interests of the corporation concerned. Very, very worrying. But, of course, and there's actually quite a lot of political resistance to this this inside the EU. But now, of course, we are at war, inverted commas, with Russia, and we're going to have to spend a lot more on military expenditure, and we're also going to sign up this trade deal so that we can get cheap gas from the
US.
Just
to come full circle, why would something like what's happening in Ukraine persuade somebody to sign this deal whether they might not otherwise?
Well, what happened in Ukraine was a deal was being done by Yanukovych with the leaders of the opposition parties, and there were three mediators in the room, all from the EU. In other words, there was no US mediator in the room. And Yanukovych had agreed to early elections to reduce the power of the presidency and to form a government of national unity with the opposition, all of which had been signed off as a kind of solution for the crisis. And then suddenly, these mysterious snipers started killing everybody, and before, within 24 hours, the regime had fallen, and we've got a new regime with very strong right-wing roots. The Ukrainian fascists are real fascists. They fought with the Nazis in World War II. They carried out assassinations and murders of Poles and Jews. The Ukrainian SS were the people who finally finished off the Warsaw Uprising in 1944. So these people have got very, very strong right-wing roots. And the situation, I see the situation, it's becoming clearer as time goes on. The EU, if you remember that Victoria Nuland, the US State Department figure who was also bugged, she said F the EU, if you remember, and that's effectively what happened. A deal between the EU, Yanukovych and the opposition to try and stabilise the situation was sabotaged. Sabotaged, I would suggest, from Washington.
Why would you say Washington?
Because they want people to sign up to their trade deal, and they wouldn't necessarily do it unless they've. I mean, don't forget that the Gladio network, the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, the Dortmund beer hall massacre, the Brabant massacres in Belgium in the 1980s, all geared to keeping Western Europe in the US. Sphere of influence. Well, and this is the same going on in Ukraine.
Fascinating insight, potentially, into what's been going on. But what do you, the people at Bristol, think? Well, Marina Morris, now she's back, has been out and about this week asking you, what do you think of the crisis in Ukraine?
The UK granted Ukraine territorial independence in return for giving up its nuclear weapons. Is it important to keep your promises, or is it a danger to upset Russia?
I mean, who's going to start a war between Russia and... We all know what wars are. They kill it, damages to both sides equally. And I can't see them doing anything stronger than what they've done so far.
I think it's probably too dangerous to upset Russia.
I agree. I think it's... Yeah, I'd be scared to upset Russia.
Human beings fight. That's just fact. And always will be. Human beings have always fought
Animals.
And killed each other. It's just the way it is.
I was never particularly in favour of breaking up the Soviet Union. In the first place, I thought that was a mistake, and I think there's issues there about democracy. I mean, obviously Ukraine is trying to achieve democracy, and the issue is really is whether Russia's a democracy, which it plainly isn't, but I don't think solutions to these issues about democracy and accountability are best expressed through nationalism.
Keep your promises, I suppose. Basically, it's all difficult because I don't trust any of them. No government is good. They are all bad. Don't trust any of them. That's everything you hear in the newspapers and on the news isn't true anyway. Well, they just unsign it. They can do anything they want, really.
Keep your promises, definitely. You can't be afraid of another country at the end of the day. If you're afraid of a country, they've got too much power.
How can we persuade other countries to give up nuclear weapons?
French and the English both have nuclear weapons. I can't see any of either of them giving them up. They've sworn to use them in conjunction with the NATO action, unless by complete agreement with all countries who have them. I know there is a big danger of proliferation with other countries taking them on. And that's likely to happen with Iran, for example, already with North Korea. I don't know the answer to that one.
There's no incentive for anybody to give up nuclear weapons.
But the power is.
Yeah. International law is based on those people that have nuclear weapons. So if there is international law, you should have nuclear weapons because you can make the law. No. I don't think Russia are expanding. They've taken Crimea and they can have that. That's all right. I think they're all right.
But a lot of the Russians were like culturally Russian anyways.
Well, we're setting an example ourselves and giving up our nuclear weapons.
You cannot do it because if you give them up, you haven't got the weapons to use them. You've got the weapons to stop the other weapons being used. You just won't. It will never happen.
I don't think that will ever happen because everyone won't always give up their nuclear weapons. Someone's going to always have them, so someone else is going to need them for protection.
Is their Russian expansion a danger for the West? Could we be heading to a new Cold War?
The danger is because you have ethnic Russians living in these areas, there may be a move by the Russians, put them all together under one, you know, really to go back to the original status of Russia. That is a danger. I can see a Cold War happening where we put up barriers and won't go any further, put our heels in. They're not going to take us on ordinary Cold War without the actual atomic bomb being brought in. Wars are dangerous for everybody. Neither can win, and I don't see why a group of ethnic origin Russian people shouldn't live in Ukraine quite happily. In England, we're a mixture of all sorts, and yet we live together.
Well, it isn't an expansion. Ukraine, up to what, 15, 20 years ago, was part of Russia. Crimea has been part of Russia. It's probably more linguistically part of Russia than it is part of Ukraine. I don't approve of Russia, what it's doing, but I think it's a sort of a regional issue, and I think it should be kept in that context. I think there's a case for seizing Russian assets, particularly of the oligarchy that rules Russia, and sort of making a message to take home that they can't behave in that sort of manner. But danger, do we want to escalate to anything near war? And I would say no to that. What's deemed to be a national interest is often in the ruling class's interest, and that needs to change.
It depends how it's done. If it's done by force, because we've got a moral act to act. If it's done properly through a democracy, then no. No, I don't think so. I don't think we'll get that far.
Wars on all the time. All the time we've had wars, right? Small natures, admittedly, but it's been constant.
What should we do?
Human beings which are at fault, and everybody needs to work together to try to dampen down this conflict.
That was Marina Morris out and about on the streets of Bristol asking you what you thought of the Ukraine crisis and also the nuclear implications. But Marina, I was very impressed actually that you didn't find too many people saying that they didn't care or didn't know. A lot of people seem to understand it. Anyway, you want to you're doing something with a new website, I believe.
Absolutely. So. You're absolutely right, Tony, today's Vox Pop seems to show that many people are indifferent to the problem in Ukraine and far away from political hotspots. They believe that who is military stronger dictates the rules and tries the laws. But I know many other people are concerned about unfair societies, and I am launching my website. This is a film based on the opinions of Bristolians about indifference. I did this Vox Pop last year and asked people, do we live in a different society? And I got the answers. At that time, Ukraine was peaceful and free, and who want to know this answer of Bristolians about do we live in indifferent society can go to www.mpersonality.com.
Okay, that's www.mpersonality.com. And thank you particularly for the Vox Pop. Nice to have you back with the Vox Pops again, Marina. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Okay, on to the airliner then, MH370, Martin. This is a pretty shocking story. The problem seems to be that we've got British companies, one of the problems anyway, pontificating on what's going on out there in the Indian Ocean. We've got two companies, both one is Intelsat, that's the satellite people. Another one is the Air Accident Investigation Branch. And it seems that the Malaysian government are taking advice from them as to where this aircraft is, or if it's crashed or if it's not. I mean, I would simply say, now we know that the aircraft travelled on for 5 hours after it was originally supposed to have been lost. Aircraft do not just travel for 5 hours and then crash, losing all people on board. It just doesn't happen. An aircraft can quite easily ditch in the ocean, and if so, you would obviously get quite a lot of wreckage, and you will get life rafts, some survivors. But why is it that we're being told that this aircraft has just simply disappeared? I just find it impossible to believe, as do the families of the people who are on that aircraft. One thing that people are looking at is a potential cyber hijack. In fact, the British anti-terror expert, Dr. Sally Leversley, said literally straight away after, this is on Sunday the 16th of March, that she said the hackers could change the plane's speech. She was thinking that that it was the world's first cyber hijack. They can change the plane speed, altitude, and direction by sending radio signals to its flight management system. Could then be landed or made to crash by remote control. Possible culprits include criminal gangs, terrorists, or a foreign power. Now that means just about any military, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, the Global Hawk technology has existed since the 1970s, and the US flew an airliner across the Pacific and landed in Australia without a pilot, even in the 1970s. And if you look at the movements of the four hijacked aeroplanes on 9/11, they didn't fly directly to their targets. They flew in very bizarre zigzag patterns across the United States airspace, without being intercepted by the United States Air Force, it might be added, and they were probably, in my view, flying from the ground using Global Hawk technology.
Well, this,
and if you think about it, modern technology with everything on computers, it's all hackable. The Iranians have taken down US drones through hacking them. Hezbollah in Lebanon managed to hack into the Israeli drones, and therefore
now, look, there's a problem with this technology.
There's
a problem with the discussing this technology even on the news for many of the powers that use it, and that is that it's secret military technology. They don't really want this kind of stuff to be going out to Joe Public and be chit-chatting about it here, there and everywhere. So that's one aspect of this. Another thing is that, I mean, I have looked at the avalanche of denials on certain stories. I mean, for example, when Rolls-Royce first announced that they believed that the plane had flown on for several hours afterwards, what we got was so much in the way of denials from all of the various countries involved, not actually, I don't think, from China, but certainly from Malaysia, who are taking their information more from the West, that we were being told no, actually Rolls-Royce didn't get this information. They even managed to get a retraction from Rolls-Royce itself. Now that this has since proved to be the case, that it certainly did fly on for 4 or 5 hours. And so when I see a mass of denials about people that actually don't know what happened, I get very suspicious that news management is going on around the world. And of course, there are really only a handful of big corporations that control a fantastic amount of the news that we see and hear every day nowadays. The other thing is the Maldives story. There was a story came out in a little Maldives newspaper last week. Again, if you were to look that story up on the internet anywhere, all you will find is 50, and I don't kid you, 50 denials that the story was true. Now, how can all the people who were denying whether these people had seen this aircraft in the Maldives have even known whether they'd seen it or not? So I get very suspicious about news management, and I just wonder, Martin, your thoughts about whether you think that that might be taking place here. And this is one of the reasons, well, obviously, why these families are getting so angry. Now, they are now actually suing the Malaysian government.
Well, I think you're quite right to suspect that news management is going on around this incident. It's an extremely mysterious incident. For example, it's quite clear that people phoned the mobile phones of people on the planes and the phones rang but nobody answered.
Yeah, that was broadcast live on Malaysian television. Yeah. People actually phoning the phones. It didn't go to voicemail. It didn't say this number's disconnected. It actually rang.
I would say that I don't know what happened here. But
I mean, if that's the case, surely the NSA will be able to trace that.
Well,
indeed,
somebody does know. People like the NSA and GCHQ probably know exactly what's happened here, but we don't.
And the problem is, of course, the families are being told, well, you can mourn for your loved ones, but we can't give you any wreckage or bodies.
Yes, and we don't really know what's happened, and the plane may, in fact, be... I mean, one theory I saw, that the plane may be being cut up for spare parts. It may be an act of piracy, or it may have some political implications, as you were suggesting earlier. Hard to guess,
now,
isn't
it? Let's look at... I mean, the sort of people who are suffering are a lot of the families, obviously. You know, there are 239 passengers and crew on there, so there's many, many people suffering in that way. But there's also... The Malaysian government has suffered a blow as well, hasn't it? And the Chinese government has suffered a blow with this. Are there any motives for anybody to be threatening or wanting to prod the Malaysian government? Tell us a bit about Malaysia. What kind of country is it, and how does it fit into the global context?
Well, the former president of Malaysia, Mahathir Mohamad, is a fairly outspoken character. He's actually, for example, had 9/11 conferences held in Malaysia questioning the official story. During the 1998 Asian financial crisis, the Malaysians refused IMF advice not to put on exchange controls. They put on exchange controls rather successfully and managed to stabilise the crisis in Malaysia. So traditionally, Malaysia, a largely Muslim country, has been a thorn in the flesh, I'll put it no stronger than that, of the establishment in the West. And of course China is regarded as a number one rival and threat. So it may be that the message is being sent to the leadership in Malaysia and China, or it may be something else entirely. I mean, I don't think we should jump to conclusions, but that's a possibility.
Well, going back to the cyber hijack theory, which is, I must admit, my favourite one, at least I think it's probably the most credible, is last April, German security consultant Hugo Tiso, who is also a commercial pilot, unveiled a way to hijack a plane remotely using a phone. And it has to be said that the 777 was the first aircraft in production where the pilots didn't have any kind of direct control at all of any of the controls of the plane. Addressing the Hack in the Box security summit in Amsterdam last May, he said he had spent 3 years developing a series of malicious codes on a mobile phone app called Plane Spoil that hacked into an aircraft's security system right into the plane. That's using an Android phone.
Yeah, so I mean, initially this kind of technology of hacking into airliners and crashing them into buildings probably only, for example, only in the hands of states, because they're the only ones who are big enough to develop.
Well, militaries.
Yeah. But what's beginning to happen, of course, is that these technologies inevitably start to spread.
I mean, is it this simple that Boeing actually don't want to admit this, or they don't want to engage with it? I mean, Boeing obviously don't want people worried that some kid is going to be sitting on a phone below the plane hacking into it.
Well, if I was the Russian or Chinese militaries, I'd make sure that all of my planes had manual override. It's an obvious thing to do. And if I was NATO, I would insist on the same as well. But of course, in actual fact, with the increasing cyberneticisation of warfare, that's not the case. But of course, the whole drone business is quite interesting in this context, because the Iranians and Hezbollah in Lebanon have managed to hack into Israeli and American drones. And of course, they don't really want to give away at what level they've hacked into them, because it could be, for example, that hundreds of drones are sent to whack Iran, and the Iranians just send them all back to base to blow up where they were sent from.
Okay,
if they've hacked into it effectively.
On the timing of this, 3 weeks ago tomorrow, disappearance of MH370, the aircraft. Martin, it was around about the same time as the vote was being taken at the United Nations Security Council over whether there should be action against Russia with regard to Crimea. Now, the Chinese, I would say quite wisely, completely abstained on that vote. Do you think there may have been pressure on them to vote against Russia?
Well, there was pressure on them to vote against Russia for sure. I mean, we've had the UN vote this week where lots of countries, the Russians are complaining that lots of countries basically have their arms twisted. You know, you support us on this, or we're going to cut off your credit line, cut off your insulin supply, make life difficult for you. So, yes, there could be pressure. And don't forget that what seems to be happening in Ukraine is also happening simultaneously in Venezuela. There's an attempt to overthrow the Maduro government in Venezuela. And I suggest that we are, in fact, seeing a rollout of a gameplay by NATO all over the world, not just in Ukraine.
So do you think there's any real motive for an attack on Malaysia or China, almost out of the blue?
Well, I suggest to you that Malaysia and China are seen as part of the awkward squad, as are Venezuela and other similar countries. That doesn't mean that we can jump to conclusions about what's happened here. It's too complicated to say.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, back to the bad old days this week of US-sponsored military rule in Egypt after the halcyon days of the Arab Spring and also Turkey shooting down a Syrian jet and a leaked phone call from the Prime Minister Erdogan. And he wants to get a war started with Syria. And I'm joined, very happy to be, by Iqbal Tamimi, Palestinian journalist. Iqbal, hi and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, what are your thoughts about what's been happening in Egypt? Because I think over the last week or so, I mean, we've been following this obviously for the last couple of years as to the ordinary people in Egypt's wish to have democracy. Then we had originally the overthrowing of Mubarak, who was really a Western puppet, friendly with the American military, did what they wanted. And we had Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood, came to power with a slim majority. And then what happened? independence. He tried to tinker with the judicial system because the military still had quite a lot of power over some of those judges. And when he started to actually bring the judicial system within democratic control, that's when the military decided we're not having this guy anymore, and they've now taken over. Now the announcement this week, between 200 and 300 and possibly more people being given the death sentence.
Well, since the President Mohamed Morsi was overthrown on July the 3rd, at least 16,000 people have been arrested, and reports of abuse in custody have surged. Political trials have been riddled with process violations and arbitrary prosecutions. What happens is after the military coup, everybody now is doubting any kind of impartiality of elections or referendum. There was almost a mass death sentence when Egyptian judge Saeed Al-Jazar handed down a verdict condemning 529 people to execution altogether. The verdict was severe, and the defense lawyers were barred from meeting their clients or cross-examine witnesses. The condemned people were accused of belonging to the Muslim Brotherhood, the now banned Islamist group that ruled Egypt until 9 months ago, and which the current government has declared a terrorist organization. On August the 14th, in the wake of the military coup, riot police officers violently dispersed an encampment of Morsi supporters in East Cairo, killing an estimated 900 people. The police station attack at the center of Morsi's trial took place during that chaos. The prosecutors say that all these convicts attacked a police station in the upper Egyptian city of Minya last August, killing an officer and stealing weapons. The television stations in Egypt have aired footage allegedly showing a wounded policeman being given medical assistance after the attack. According to the defense lawyers, no such evidence was presented in court. There is little evidence to suggest that these attacks have been led by the Brotherhood. They have been claimed by a group linked to Al-Qaeda. So at the moment, the same person who nobody knew anything about before the virginity test scandal is the Sisi is now giving up on his military career and wanting to become a president, even though he promised that he will not do that when he started his, after the coup. Now everybody is really furious, but it seems that he managed, and the military managed, to frighten the people. Now nobody dares to declare support of the Brotherhood or to even sympathize with them.
Martin, I know that one of the guys that's been over there as an envoy from the United States is Frank Wisner Jr. He's been advising the Egyptian military on what to do, and it seems that he may have been helping give advice to them, essentially saying that, you know, you've got to outlaw the Brotherhood, you've got to have big death sentences, you've got to have a reign of fear. Now, his father was Frank Wisner Sr. He was at the CIA, one of the key people who was bringing Nazis across after World War II in order to give them safe haven in the United States, give them new identities and this kind of thing. I mean, he was actually at the core of the relationship between post-war America and very active SS Nazis. This is his son that's been advising the Egyptians.
Well, I mean, the US has had very big power in Egypt since Sadat took power in the 70s. And all three big players in Egyptian politics are very heavily influenced by the US. So that's the military itself, which of course is supplied with weaponry, British and US weaponry. The Muslim Brotherhood has got a long-standing relationship with Western intelligence services because they've been used as a means of undermining secular leadership in Egypt going back to the 1950s and Nasser. And of course the modern liberal youth that supposedly spearheaded the revolution 2 years ago, many of them have received training from CANVAS, which is the April 15th movement or the April 7th movement. A lot of these people have been trained in the US. Now, bizarrely enough, there is still an anti-American rhetoric in the politics of Egypt. So the Muslim Brotherhood claims that the army is run by the Americans, the Americans claim the Muslim Brotherhood is run by the Americans, and they both claim that the liberal secular opposition is run by the Americans. And factually, it just shows how important Egypt is to the US, that they try to back all the horses to make sure that whoever wins, the US continues to control the politics of the country. And it still does. And of course, now, the Israelis also have a very strong interest in outcomes in Egypt.
Well, they certainly will be rather happy to see Egypt in turmoil. Now, what are your thoughts about what's been going on with Qatar as well recently, Iqbal? Because the Gulf states seem to have fallen out of love with Qatar. I mean, it's very well known in this country, in a way, because of the Al Jazeera channel which comes from there. So give us your thoughts on that.
The GCC countries never encountered anything like what we are facing right now.
That's the Gulf Cooperation Council.
Yes, at the moment it seems that there are two camps. On one side there is Qatar, and on the other side there is Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain. Immediately after Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Qatar withdraw their ambassadors from Qatar, everybody was shocked because nobody anticipated such harsh move, and they started sort of words kind of or media war, using
words,
their own newspapers and press. And I can assure you that we have never had such harsh accusations of each other. On one side, now Qatar, being a very small area country, now try to play a bigger part in the politics of the Middle East, and this was not welcomed by United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
And what do you think of Al Jazeera? I mean, we get it on Freeview here in Bristol, so I mean, I tend to watch it quite often, and it seems to be, I mean, you get Russia Today, which seems to be very biased towards the Russians, and you get, you know, the Western channels, which are quite biased against Russia in things like Ukraine. But say it's another, I think, quite reasonably independent perspective you get. But anyway,
maybe you are watching the English version of,
yes,
of Al Jazeera. To be honest, I've been watching both. The English Al Jazeera version is more, let's say, professional. Media-wise, more balanced. If you're watching the Arab version, it's a little bit, it's like use some kind of policies which are not acceptable by professional media. For example, using a background music that incites you to...
Oh, I see. That's always a bit creepy, isn't it? I mean, I've seen the BBC doing that with some of their documentaries recently, where you're supposed to have a documentary, but then when a certain person is talked about or shown on the screen, you have spooky music in the background. You know, it's kind
of... Well, they use terms, for example, like a martyr, who... These kind of expressions are not used by the media professionals because it is a kind of point of view, who is a martyr. Religious kind of, sometimes religious kind of expressions here and there. And you feel that they are sometimes involved. It's not that they are not independent and showing, you know, both sides of the story. So I presume that whatever Al Jazeera is broadcasting might be affecting the outcome of how people perceive the news. Especially in Egypt, there is a large percentage of people who are illiterate. They don't read, but they hear the news, they watch the news.
And so the television is the way to reach people that are illiterate.
And people's soft spot is religion, usually. Yeah. This is how you can ignite their enthusiasm, you know, to be with this side or to be with the other side. So I think even though the Al Jazeera was a phenomenon when it was established many years ago, and it was like one of its own, but at the moment, I don't think it is on the same level as it used to be.
Okay, Saudi Arabia, I know that Obama's been there, hasn't really been covered much.
Today, yes. Today, Obama is going to Saudi Arabia, and as far as I know, the White House has announced appointing Robert Mouly as director of the National Security Council in March, just shortly before President Obama's visit to the Saudi Arabia. Mouly worked on the peace process during the administration of President Clinton, and he is expected to help in managing the relationship with the Saudi Arabia and assist in creating a policy towards involving Iran in solving some problems. Of course, Saudi Arabia wouldn't want Iran to be part of this equation, but Obama is until now refusing to resort to any kind of military action against Syria.
I mean, so someone who's from the Middle East yourself, I mean, for a lot of us, Saudi Arabia just simply looks like some kind of client state of the United States or the West. They just do what they're told. They're actually, although they have a lot of oppressive laws that they don't really get criticised in the media much here, because they are this kind of client state, there's obviously that big relationship with oil. But how do you see it as someone from the Middle East?
Well, we all know that Saudi Arabia is the number one importer of arms from USA. And at the moment, for example, human rights files have been put aside. People are online, trying to convey a message to Obama to use this visit, for example, to talk about things like women's rights and driving and the gay rights and things like this, but he wouldn't, break that kind of bondage or relationship with Saudi Arabia to improve,
But is it the sort of country you would like to live?
No, necessarily, no, not at all. Because, I mean, it depends on your own personality. I know a great deal about Saudi Arabia. As a woman, I can't live one day in Saudi Arabia because everything is banned. I don't like to be told what to do or have a guardian to tell me if I can get married or not in my age or if I can have a medical operation or not. I have to have, even if I want to go to the police station to file a complaint against my guardian who beats me up, for example, I can't do that because he is supposed to take me to the police station. So all these contradictions make it difficult.
We've had a lot of exposed over the last few weeks to do with the Saudi royal family as well, and the very bad treatment of their women.
Yes, one of his wives, ex-wives, the king's ex-wives, is living in London, and she hasn't seen her daughters for many, many years.
That's,
I think,
right,
13 years or more, and all four of them live like prisoners, and I think they conveyed their, the situation, which is really bad, through email, and it was reported openly.
Now, Martin, I'd like to move on to Turkey, because we've had some pretty shocking stuff this week from Erdogan. This leaked, I mean, it's obviously not much point in playing it because it's all in Turkish, but he's saying on a leaked phone call that he actually wants to start a war, and actually possibly even killing people on his own soil in order to blame Syria to get going. Now, not only that, there's also been a Syrian plane shot down by the Turks this week.
Well, yes, I mean, this brings us back to what happened at Ghouta in Damascus with the chemical weapons attack last year, which was nearly a casus belli with Britain and the United States. And that linked back pretty comprehensively. I think that it's now clear because of research by the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the UN weapons inspectors themselves, again, not really reported in the Western media, that linked back to Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia. And this, of course, Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia works very closely with CIA, MI6. So it's quite possible that chemical weapons attack was carried out by our own secret services. right here in Blighty, may be in fact the guilty parties. But if you come back to what we're talking about Turkey there, there's been an attempts all along to stir the pot and create conflict, and Erdogan is in a very I'm finding the situation in the whole Middle East very difficult to follow, because it's like a kaleidoscope of changing alliances, with Qatar falling out with Saudi Arabia. I mean, they were very much on the same page about Libya, for example, and now they're squabbling. And the Erdogan, at one stage, he got rid of the NATO generals who were in the Ergonican network in Turkey, and he was a democratic Islamist leader and so on. But he's working with the West to destabilise Syria. There are people trying to destabilise him from the street. The whole world is in a turmoil, and it's a very dangerous situation. But there's lots of provocations going on.
But this is being talked about in Turkey. This is a big security breach. It's very terrible. But they're not really talking about what the Prime Minister said, which is horrendous.
Well, what's increasingly becoming clear, as with the NSA and Edward Snowden and all the rest of it, is that phone calls are becoming crucial in political and military conflicts. So we've had two phone calls bugged in Ukraine by the Ukrainian security services and then put up on YouTube. We've had this phone call bugged in Turkey. Who would bug the phone and release this? That's a question. It's possibly the Syrian intelligence services, possibly not. Everybody is trying to use the media as part of the war fighting strategy.
Well, one of the Turkish leftist dailies carried the headline, "I'll send four men, fire eight rockets," quoting Erdogan. This referred to a comment on the recording attributed to intelligence chief Hakan Fidan, one of Erdogan's closest allies, that if necessary he can send four men to Syria with eight rockets and fire onto empty land.
Yes, well, I mean, I'm pretty confident this is what's been going on all along.
It's a provocation, basically.
These are provocations, and this is actually and for a provocation to work, you've got to have a follow through with the media. So Al Jazeera, for example, during the Libyan business, and the final push into Tripoli by the rebels, at that morning they put up two clips showing people celebrating the victory of the revolution in Green Square in the centre of Tripoli, but by lunchtime it became clear, because this is the internet age, everybody's watching this. By lunchtime it became clear that one of these clips was from India, because the flags they were waving were Indian flags. The second clip was actually a mock-up of Green Square, which they must have made in Qatar itself, and then created a whole sort of series of people film. And of course what happened is Gaddafi's forces thought they had lost. They switched it, because once Al Jazeera had put this into the news feed, then everybody else picked up on it.
Doesn't this make you wonder if really what is happening between Turkey and Syria is really made created by one of the sides? I mean, just before what happens in Syria, Turkey was doing a great job removing all the minefields between the two countries. Mm-hmm. What is happening now? I mean, I would maybe think that this kind of provocation is not from either side.
No, it's somebody else trying to stir trouble between the two of them.
Exactly, because they were doing extra good job trying to make a kind of a good neighborhood relationships between both sides before.
When Erdogan first came to power, he was trying to say, "We've got no enemies." That was his big, "We've got no enemies, we have only friends."
Now, just to sum up, Iqbal, we've got this situation today where Egypt's military chief, Marshal Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, has announced today that he has actually resigned as Egypt's military chief, and he wants to stand to be the president. We've also had the horrendous news of the 528 supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi being sentenced to death. What are your thoughts? Are they actually going to carry out these death sentences or not? Or the track record of the Egyptians? What do you think?
We have a saying in the Arab countries. It says that if you beat somebody who is tied in a chair, the one who is loose will be frightened and he will not do anything. It's like, this is sort of a warning that we are here to commit something really, really horrendous if you dare to not to go with whatever is the military is going to do or to decide. I'm not sure. I don't think this will be carried on. I mean, because this will make it will bring an outrageous kind of feedback from everybody around the world. Okay. Especially that he is trying to say that I'm gonna do the best for Egypt.
Okay. Now, as I said, we'll have a listen now to this is a clip from a documentary called The Israel Lobby, and looking at their so-called Christian supporters from the United States, and it starts with this pastor in the US, Pastor John Hagee. We'll have a listen to this and then have a chat afterwards about the Israel Lobby.
We have millions of people in the infrastructure. We have over 22,000 spiritual leaders, and some of those spiritual leaders have a million or a million and a half names on their mailing list. We have the major radio television ministries in America supporting what we're doing, because every evangelical believes the Bible, and the Bible has a clear mandate to be supportive of the state of Israel. There's a new Hitler, and he's the president of Iran, and he intends to build nuclear weapons, and his brazen declarations against the Jews in America have been carried on the front pages of America's newspapers. Ladies and gentlemen, we must demonstrate courage. We must demonstrate intellectual honesty. We must demonstrate the willingness to stand up and to speak out. We must act now to stop Iran before the maniacal dream of exterminating the Jewish people becomes a nuclear holocaust. And I am hopeful that the American government will have the courage to help Israel in its day of adversity against tyrants. I don't think there's ever a time that you can say you have enough support. I think that our objective is to always let our elected officials know that, A, we do support Israel, and that if anyone comes against Israel in a malicious way, we would do everything in our power to see that that was their last term in office.
That's the Israel Lobby, a clip from that documentary there, Pastor John Hagee. Iqbal, he's talking about 22,000 people in the US political infrastructure. I mean, really, there's not a lot of chance to do much if he's got all that support. And they've got many, many people in the US support him financially and with their hearts and minds.
This makes me laugh sometimes, because the majority are secular people, and on both sides in Israel there is a large percentage of who claim to be Jews are secular, and also in the United States, and suddenly they become all religious and they want to obey what came in the Bible and all that. I don't think the Bible would support the idea of killing people or stealing from them or uprooting their trees or all that.
Well, no, that's all.
It is politics.
The Sermon on the Mount, I think, is basically no.
Besides, they forget about the Christian Palestinians who are suffering. They ought to read a little bit about the suffering of the Christians and their churches in Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and even in Gaza there are Palestinians who are Christians. They never mention them. The media reflect kind of an image about the Palestinians being all Muslims, homogenized kind of a group of people. There are people of every different kind of
faith.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not just faith. I mean, also politically.
Shapes and sizes.
Yeah.
Political. Anyway, Iqbal Tamimi, thanks ever so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Paul Mason said it can't be done. We're going to do it. The revolutions, Martin. The People's First World War. The Easter Rising in 1916.
Well, that was, if you think of the First World War as a kind of test to destruction of the various social systems of the combatants, of Austria-Hungary, of Germany, of Britain, of France, of Russia, and somebody was going to crack first. There was going to be an internal fissure, and people expected that Russia would crack first, or that Austria-Hungary would crack first. Who cracked first was the British Empire, because the Irish nationalists seized Dublin in 1916. They were working on the principle that England's difficulty is Ireland's opportunity, and it was actually Britain that showed the way to revolution in World War One.
And Berlin, 1916, the shop stewards and strikes apparently all over the world.
Yes, well, if you remember, before the war, the Socialist International had actually called on all workers to refuse to fight and to strike against the war. What actually happened was the ruling classes in each particular country managed to bamboozle enough people into feeling that they were under attack from the other side, and the policy of bringing the war to an end through a mass strike, as it were, died the death. And then, of course, as the war developed, stress in various countries broke out. There were people opposed to the war in Germany, people opposed to the war in France, people opposed to the war in Britain, Ireland, and Russia.
Conscription, because people were being told you're going to have to go and fight and possibly die.
Well, in Britain they were the last to bring in conscription, and conscription was never brought in Ireland because they knew that training all the Irish how to use weaponry wasn't necessarily such a good idea. Of course, lots of Irishmen did volunteer to fight in the British forces, probably more than actually very many more than were involved in the Easter Rising. But the winners get to write history.
But it's interesting. I mean, maybe the French and the Russian people were looking at the Easter Rising in Ireland, and then they had their own revolutions in those places in 1917. But the US entry into the war, tanks, gas, and the war of manoeuvre.
Well, I mean, the stalemate on the Western Front eventually led to technical breakthroughs, including the invention of the tank and the aeroplane, which changed the balance of power in warfare for the Second World War. And, of course, the US was the big winner of World War One and the big winner of World War Two. And, of course, they're still top nation as we speak, although perhaps not for much longer.
What about Kiel, 1918? What happened there?
Well, what happened, there was a rebellion inside Russia against the revolution. Against the war, and don't forget, Russia was our ally. So, that was bad for Britain and France. But at the same time, there was a rebellion in Germany. I mean, the rebellion in Germany was being encouraged by the Western powers. They were carrying out a blockade to prevent the Germans from eating properly, and encouraging their workers to rise up against the Kaiser. So, the Germans sent Lenin to Russia to encourage the Russians to rise up against the regime in Russia. So, everybody was encouraging everybody else's revolutionaries, and eventually, of course, there were attempted revolutions right across Europe.
Okay, fascinating, Martin. Next week, the aftermath. Time to sign off now. Cyrus the Virus may be up next. Murdoch News at 7. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Horfield, Claire Hiscott, and also to Iqbal Tamimi. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. See you next week.
Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, DJ Dave Lee Travis has been told he's facing a new charge of indecent assault and says his nightmare is continuing. He's already being retried after a jury couldn't agree on two counts in an earlier case. They found him not guilty of 12 other sex abuse charges. Overnight analysis is being carried out on pictures taken by search planes looking for the missing Malaysia Airlines jet. It's now thought to have come down in a different area of the Indian Ocean to the stretch being combed earlier in the week. Malaysia's acting Transport Minister Hisham Madin Hussein says they're constantly examining as much information as they can.
It is a process of continually refining data, which in turn further narrows the search area. With each step, we get closer to the understanding MH370's flight path.
There's thought failings at the Causeway Hospital in Coleraine may have led to the deaths of 11 people, including 5 babies, and investigations